it was the 11th century, the 1000s, which, as we notice, is a rather of a transition century, particularly in the papacy, which before that, or at the beginning of the century, had sunk to a position where it doubtless would have become of no influence in the world whatever if it had continued the century as it was then. But it was the German emperor plus the Cluny Reformation which restored it. And then we noticed how Hildebrand had a great deal to do with restoring it, and how he wanted the papacy to be restored, lifted up from its terribly debased situation, but he also did not wish it to be simply a tool of the emperor, of the state. And he went to the opposite extreme. Even Maturidor, in his Roman Catholic history, speaks of some of Gregory's statements about his authority over the emperors and civil rulers as going way beyond what was claimed by men who preceded him or who followed him, which is rather amazing for a book of this type to make such a statement about it, because it does try to defend the Pope's right to on most matters. But Gregory at Canossa is a mighty contrast to Benedict IX 50 years earlier. A tremendous change which had taken place. And Canossa there was a symbol which has been remembered since of the emperor standing barefoot in the cold, shivering there, in rags for 3 days, while dukes and abbots would talk to him and come in and talk to the Pope and try to get the Pope to let him into the castle. And finally, after 3 days, the Pope said, well, he's done enough penance, we'll receive him in now. And then received him in, and he knelt before the Pope, and the Pope restored him and took away the excommunication. It was a great symbol, but it didn't accomplish much for Gregory, because, as we noticed, Henry, once he got his power back, became established in Germany, then turned strongly against Gregory, and Gregory eventually had to flee. But in the end, Henry himself lost out to his own son, who rebelled against him. The two individuals in this case, it didn't make much immediate change in situations, but it made a tremendous impression, what happened at Canossa. And the papacy, the level of the papacy, had been elevated by largely by Hildebrand's influence, but he could never have done it without the particular situation. Then we notice C, separation from the Eastern Church in 1054, a date which in future years both the Eastern Orthodox Churches and the Roman Catholic Church have considered as a very crucial date, but a date which at the time was not thought of as particularly important, because they had had many separations before, when they would break off relations for a few years and then they would reestablish relations. But this time they were broken off and they have never yet been reestablished. There was never any real fellowship between their leaders until within the last few years, when Pope Paul and the leaders of the Eastern Orthodox Church met on a purely personal basis, and instead of dealing with the issues, just pushed them to the side and talked together of possible realignment. We now want to take up Chapter D, which we will call the Triumph of Superstition. Yes? Yeah. The Bishop of Rome and those who stood with him. The Bishop of Rome and those who stood with him, they declared to be excommunicated. But before they did that, the representatives of the Pope had placed on the high altar in Constantinople a similar statement about the Archbishop of Constantinople, which was signed by the Bishop of Rome, which he gave them to take with them and to issue if they thought necessary. But it was a long trip from Rome to Constantinople in those days, and 2 months before this was put on the altar there, That particular bishop of Rome had died. And so now some are saying, well, there's a question whether it was Valens. The man that tried it was, had died, maybe that excommunication wasn't valid, maybe they really haven't been separated all these years. Mussori raises that question here. But they have been in fact, and now if you can prove that theoretically they shouldn't have been, why, it'd be all that much easier to get them together. Actually, their views are not very different of the two churches. The Eastern Church has been subject to the Mohammedan attack, and that is, they've taken so much of their territory, so much of their energy has gone into defending themselves, and they took in such large groups of people, rather quickly, like the whole when the Russian Tsar accepted Christianity and his whole nation nominally became Christian. Such great large groups were taken in so rapidly that perhaps superstition has gone further in the Western Church, in the Eastern Church, than in the Western. There's been less opportunity, particularly in recent years, for education for maintaining something of a standard among their leaders. On the other hand, some of the abuses which the East has, the East hasn't carried quite so far. For instance, in the East, they do not put statues in their churches, but they do put bas-reliefs, what they call icon. Originally meant any kind of a statue or a bas-relief. Now they just use the bas-relief. But many of the people venerate those bas-reliefs almost as if they were idols. And there's a tremendous amount of superstition in many sections of the Eastern Church. The Western, at this particular time, the great bulk of the clergy in both churches were married. And the Western Church, some of the men like Gregory and others, were doing their best to get celibacy established as the rule for the church officials. And eventually they succeeded in the West. In the East, they never have made have forbidden marriage for the lower clergy. But the upper clergy are not supposed to be married. But the lower clergy in the Eastern Church marry, but not in the West. In the years since, there have occasionally been groups in the East which have differed a little from other groups and have looked to the Bishop of Rome for protection. And some of these have been received into the Roman Catholic Church under conditions which give them special privileges not enjoyed by other Roman Catholics. The privilege of having, for instance, giving the bread and the wine, not just the bread, to the people, or the privilege of holding certain particular views on certain minor points. But there are a number of such groups, but they're small compared to the total size of either of the two large organizations. So now we're going to be the triumph of superstition. And the great central superstition of which Luther was so strong against, and which is today probably the greatest single thing in maintaining a hold over ignorant people of the church. There are many superstitions that developed in the Middle Ages in the church, but the one which is perhaps the most outstanding is the idea of transubstantiation. Now, this in itself would not be so much. In the Middle Ages, there grew up all sorts of myths and legends and miraculous stories about various saints and church leaders and so on. And these, you might say, such things naturally develop where people don't have much education. That's not so vital. But the reason this is vital is because this assumes that a great miracle can be performed every day, and that this great miracle is necessary for salvation, and that this the power of performing this great miracle is limited to certain people. And so the idea of transubstantiation maintains that the value of the communion service consists in the fact that one partakes not simply of bread and wine, or not at all of bread and wine, but of the very actual body and blood of Christ. And it consists of the idea that nobody can get access to the body and blood of Christ except as one who has this miracle-working power makes it available to him. And this is what has given the Roman Catholic Church its greatest power over its people. is this doctrine of transubstantiation. The belief that the priest, by virtue of his ordination, is given the power to perform a tremendous miracle. And that when he says certain words over the bread and the wine, they are changed so that though they still look like bread, taste like bread, smell like bread, feel like bread, there is no bread there at all. It is the actual body and blood of Christ. And only the priest has the power, only the man who can ordain as a priest has the power to work this miracle. And apart from this miracle, one does not have access to the grace of Christ. I had a friend with a young man played with a boy in his neighborhood who later became a Jesuit. And this boy came to visit him when he was in the Roman Catholic Seminary, and he said, the grace of God is free, the grace of Christ, apart from it there can be no salvation. But, he said, this grace is like a great tank which has many spigots through which you can receive the grace, but at every spigot stands a Roman Catholic priest, and you cannot get it except as he makes it available to you. Now that is the belief which Luther and Calvin so strongly fought against. And it rests, you see, upon the idea of this miracle of transubstantiation. Now it is true that Jesus Christ said, except you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you can have no life in you. Well, now those words are very, very strong words. And if they are to be taken in absolute literalness, then the actual literal body and blood of Christ must in some way be made available for us. But it's pretty hard to think that those people to whom Christ in the flesh was talking thought that that was what he meant at all. And we believe that it is true that except you spiritually feed on Christ, you cannot have life in you. And we believe that we feed on him. We receive his grace. We partake of his very nature. He enters into us. He lives in us. And we are crucified with him. But we believe it is a spiritual transaction. Now you'll very often hear the term the real presence. And there's been great controversy about the real presence of Christ in the sacrament. But this is a term which is interpreted in various ways. Some will say, if you mean the real presence, you mean this actually is the very body and blood of Christ, the very body and blood which suffered on the cross. But others, when they say the real presence, will mean Christ is actually there, spiritual. And so there is a certain ambiguity in the term, the real presence. Of course, there are those who will say, no, there's no presence at all, there's just a wonderful symbol. A symbol of the fact that we have to have be saved through Christ, that we have fellowship with him, that we feed upon him, purely a symbol. And that attitude, Luther was very incensed against. He said, no, this is my body. Christ is really here. And he insisted on a real presence, but so did Calvin. Calvin insisted on a real spiritual presence. Luther said, the very body and blood of Christ are in, with, and under the elements, because they are everything. But the bread is not changed, it is still bread. The wine is not changed, it is still wine. The priest has no magical power. This was perhaps the greatest subject of controversy at the time of the Reformation. Yes, sir?
Is it unusual for one to run into a woman who has a son,
yes,
a fellow intellectual woman, who would not hold this presence, but would rather have been taught that it is simply a symbol?
Yeah. I would say that 20 years ago, that would have been extremely unusual. 20 years ago, any Roman Catholic priest who would make such a statement, if it came to the attention of the authorities, would be immediately excommunicated. But today, the process of infiltrating Christian institutions, real or nominal Christians, with unbelief and modernism, has proceeded so far, not merely in Protestant areas, but also in Roman Catholic areas. that it is not surprising today what belief you find on the part of any Roman. Some of them are just as modernist as any so-called Protestant you find today. The change has come seemingly very rapid. Of course, actually, it's not nearly as rapid as it seems, but in the Roman Church, it was kept under. They were afraid to express themselves. And now that until the numbers that were filled with these views became large enough that they dared speak up. And today, they are speaking out pretty strongly. And I wouldn't be surprised if the views of Protestant theologians call the death of God. I don't know whether there are any Romanists who would use such terminology, but certainly very similar views are held by some people. You'll find almost any view that, what, 20 years ago, that would have said, you wouldn't dare to say that. Yes, Mr. West? Oh, they're a great man. Although 20 years ago, there would have been less danger in denying that than in denying sacrifice. This was the very center. This was the very central set of their system. And one wonders what the result will be, because there are so very, very many who have a blind loyalty to the church. So very, very many who have been taught simply to accept without trying to understand. And great numbers of people like that, when they find their leaders expressing such divergent views from each other, one just wonders what the effect will be. I don't think there's ever been a time since the Reformation when there's been as great an opportunity for real Christian witness among Roman Catholics as there is today, but alas, the numbers who are actually interested in doing it is far smaller than it has been at most churches, because of the infiltration of Protestantism also. But now, this matter of transubstantiation then has been the very central thing in the whole Roman Catholic organization and their system. But it is important to notice how it developed. Now, of the various superstitions which have become crystallized and held as dogma, it is often very hard to show just when they started or how they developed, because often the development has been gradual, with people discussing and people preaching and people presenting ideas, and gradually a thing has spread. It was as recently as about 1950, wasn't it, when the Pope declared the doctrine of the taking to heaven of the body of the Virgin Mary. That was declared as a doctrine in 1950 by the Pope, but he did not say he was declaring a new doctrine. He was declaring that this is a true doctrine. And before that, while there had been many who did not believe it, there had been individuals and even large groups which had held this for many centuries. It's one of the very superstitions that developed during the Middle Ages. And it's usually very hard to pinpoint the progress of it. So it is extremely interesting that we can pinpoint to a very slight extent, but yet to a very important extent, the progress of the idea of transubstantiation. We notice that during the 9th century, during the 800s, we notice that Pascasius Radbursis wrote his book in which he presented the idea of transubstantiation, and it is the earliest clear presentation of the idea. He didn't use the term came used later, but it's the earliest clear presentation of the idea of which we have evidence. There are those today, of course, who hold strong as it will say, why, sure, it's taught right in the gospel. Jesus said, except you eat my bread, eat my flesh and drink my blood. It's right there. And they can find similar statements in the early fathers, which they say present. But they all are susceptible of other interpretations. But the first clear presentation of this view is by Pascasius Radbursis in his book, in which his big question was, What happened to the blood of Christ after a person eats it? That was the big question you could discuss. It would be insisted one proves it. One proves the body of Christ with its teeth. One mixes it with saliva. He uses the strongest physical language in relation to it and to his insistence that this miracle actually occurs. And Retramnus opposed it and said it is not true. Christ is spiritually present there. There is not a physical transformation. And Retramnus was not condemned for his view. The other view had gained so much standing by that time that the majority of the leadership tended to hold it. But Retramnus was considered as a great scholar and a great thinker, and it was very interesting to know what he thought about the proposition, even if many of them thought he was wrong. But now, 200 years later, we find a man who was considered as a very great scholar, a man who felt exactly as Retramnus had done, and who felt it was important enough that he was anxious to express his view very strongly and very clearly. And this man's name is Berengut. He lived from about 1000 to 1088, and he was a popular teacher. He was a good scholar. He was a monk who tried to live a spiritual life, who spoke about the temptations in the monastery. He wrote much that we can consider to have been very good. But he came to the conclusion between the years 1040 and 1045 that the idea that Tascasius Radbergus had advanced 200 years before was a vulgar superstition contrary to the scriptures, to the fathers, and to reason. And he began to express his view. And yes? Okay. Berengut. B-E-R-E-N-G-A-R. B-E-R-E-N-G-A-R. Who lived from 1000 to 1088. And he began to express his view. And the important thing, the interesting thing to us, is not the fact that he held such a view, nor the fact that he expressed it. But the reaction that it received, the difference that had come in 200 years in the attitude toward a man who would hold such a view from the attitude that was taken toward the tramp. Because when he presented his view, it created a great sensation. It was widely held that transubstantiation was true, and he had to have the priest who had been ordained and was able to perform this miracle in order to get salvation. And so, when he began to present this view, he was very strongly criticized, and a fellow student of his named Lanfranc, L-A-N-F-R-A-N-C, Lanfranc, who a little later became the Archbishop of Canterbury in England, so appointed by William the Conqueror. A man who was also a scholar and who was a prominent leader, condemned the views of Berengut very strongly. And in 1050, the Lanfranc was in Rome, presented Berengut's views for condemnation to a Roman synod held under Pope Leo IX and attended mostly by Italian bishops, and they issued a condemnation of him. And they announced they would hold another meeting that fall, and they would summon him to appear before it, and when he did not come, the King of France prevented him on that occasion. He did not come. They issued a second condemnation, and they burned the Book of Retramnus on it. And then word was brought back to France about it, and a synod met in France in 1054. And he was tried before the synod. And it so happened that this synod in France was presided over by a friend of Berengut, a man named Hildebrand, whom we have already mentioned. another connection. Hildebrand was now the representative of the Pope. In France, he listened calmly to Berenguer's argument, and he seemed to have been perfectly satisfied when Berenguer said the consecrated bread and wine are really, in a spiritual sense, the body and blood of Christ. And Hildebrand said that is satisfactory. And Hildebrand was willing to leave it an open question whether there was actually a change of substance or not. But Hildebrand was not represented in this particular regard. Hildebrand invited him to go to Rome with him for a final settlement in order that he should be cleared. And so, confiding in this powerful advocate, Berenguer went to Rome with him. And in 1059, there was a council held in Rome, 113 bishops present, and when Berenguer presented his views, he said later about it, he said they acted like wild beasts. They would not listen to his idea of spiritual communion. They said you actually take the very physical body and blood of Christ. It looks like bread and wine, but it isn't. It is the body and blood of Christ. And one of the cardinals, in the name of the synod, wrote a formula of recantation which cut off all spiritual interpretation and insisted on a literal mastication of Christ's body. And Schaff says that Berenguer might have been a martyr, and his views, he thinks, might have gained if he had been a martyr, but he did not have the courage of a martyr. And when this attitude was taken by the synod, he accepted this confession on his knees before the synod and threw his book into the fire. And then he said later, he said, human wickedness has extorted from human weakness a different confession, but a change of conviction can be effected only by the agency of Almighty God. That's what he said later. He didn't say that before the synod. He said he would rather trust to the mercy of God than to the charity of his enemies. And he found comfort in the pardon granted to Aaron and to St. Peter. And he came back to France after having publicly repudiated his views of way. But when he got back there, that far from Rome, he began to speak out as strong as ever. And he used language about the Pope, the two popes he had appeared before, the one who had just died and the new one who had taken the same attitude. He used language as severe as Luther used 5 centuries later. He condemned these popes in the strongest language for their stand against the truth. He defended his real convictions more boldly than ever. Lanfranc wrote a book attacking him. Berenguer replied very sharply. And his friends gradually decided that he was a good man not to get too close to him. The wrath of his enemies grew so intense that at a synod held in France, he was nearly killed. But then, Hildebrand became Pope, as Gregory said. And he heard about what was happening in France, and people were talking about Berenguer, and Hildebrand, who evidently was a friend of Berenguer's, summoned him to Rome, thinking, I saved him from difficulties in France when I was in the synod there. Maybe I can explain it and show people he's really orthodox, even if he doesn't believe in the physical things of the elements. He believes in the real presence of Christ. So Gregory VII summoned him to Rome and made several attempts to protect him against the fanaticism of his enemies, but they demanded absolute recantation or death. And at a council in Rome in 1079, they required him to sign a formula that declared the substance was actually changed and you actually see with the teeth the body and blood of Christ. And he said, I talked with Hildebrand, he says my views are not heretical. And Gregory found he couldn't risk his own reputation for orthodoxy and sternly ordered him to confess his error. And Berenguer said later, he said, confounded by the sudden madness of the Pope, And because God, in punishment for my sins, did not give me a steadfast heart, I threw myself on the ground and confessed with impious voice that I had erred, fearing the Pope would instantly pronounce against me the sentence of excommunication, and that as a necessary consequence, the populace would hurry me off to the worst of death. The Pope, however, gave him two letters of recommendation and threatened with anathema any who should do him any harm or should call him a heretic. And he had publicly confessed he was wrong and begged forgiveness and all that, and so Gregory protected him. He returned to France with a desponding heart and gave up the hopeless contest. And the difference in the treatment of Berengar from the treatment of Rathanus 2 centuries later shows how the superstition had gained during the period. Schaff says Berengar was a strange compound of moral courage and physical cowardice. Had he died a martyr, his doctrine would have gained strength, but by his repeated recantation, he injured his own cause and promoted the victory of transubstantiation. So that Berengar does not leave us a record that we can praise him for. We can praise him perhaps for the cleanness of his thought, but certainly not for his willingness to stand by his conviction. But it is a very clear evidence of the triumph of superstition, the fact that this and other superstitions had so gained such a standing that it was impossible for anyone to speak against him without being in serious danger of his life. Now we, yes?
I'm wondering what evidence there is that the podcast and the statement
that is what you call, that's a condition contrary to fact. The fact is that there are people in history who have stood for their convictions and died like Wycliffe did, and died and whose convictions later have gained force. But actually, when you look at the facts, Wycliffe's followers were persecuted and burned and mistreated, and there were very few of them left when the Reformation came to England. Tertullian said the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church, but it takes more than the blood of the martyrs. A man can die as a martyr for his faith, and wickedness can completely overwhelm an area, and he can be completely forgotten. But if, after a person dies for his faith, then there comes a period of freedom, then people remember him, and he may accomplish a tremendous lot. But you find so many in both cases that I would say Schaff is giving an opinion here which has no basis. I would say superstition had grown so great that if Berengar had been killed, I don't think his instance would have been any greater than it was. But you cannot honor him with the way that he so abjectly submitted. You may think that perhaps if he didn't have the strength to stand and die for his conviction, he should have been a little more careful before that about speaking quite as strongly and quite as boldly as he did when it came to the issue. He just didn't have the courage to stand. But that would have made any difference in the outcome if he had, I don't personally believe, in the situation that was there. Yes? Yes. 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 That's a little bit involved. I would say. Whether he believed that or not, I don't know whether he went quite that far. We haven't given it to him. There were many excommunicated who later had the ban lifted. That often happened. And I just don't know. But it shows how the superstition had grown, how it spread by this time. Now we go on to the 12th century. And the 10th century we spoke of as a transition period. But it was a transition period in which there were a few outstanding events which show the change that was taking place. There are certain regards in which in the 12th century a change is taking place, but there is not so much of great importance in itself during the 12th century, though there are certain things that are the beginning of very important developments that follow that. So we won't spend a great deal of time on the 1100. In fact, capital A, the papacy, capital A, the papacy, I'm going to spend comparatively little time on, although there were popes of whom we know a great deal during this period, and who had many events in their lives that seemed of great importance to people at the time. There's no great stark change like there was in the 10th century. There is a continuation on from the line that Gregory had established. So under A, the papacy, we'll make number one the general situation, and we will not say a great deal about it, except to say simply that there is quite a succession of popes, no one of the low character of Benedict IX or even opposing them. The reform had taken hold to the extent that with the power of the German emperor ready to intervene in case of any tendency towards a dropping back to those terrible situations before, and with a great many of the people who were sincerely interested in maintaining a high standard for the papacy, the Pope during this century probably averaged better character than in almost any century before then. They averaged pretty fair character and pretty fair ability. There are no great outstanding men among them. There is no one who is as important as Gregory VII. No one who is a great thinker like Leo I. There are no great outstanding men, but neither are there any great disgraceful characters among them. And we will not take time to go in detail into them. I mentioned to you Adrian IV, whom we've mentioned before. Adrian IV is of interest for two reasons. First, because he's the only Englishman who's ever been pope. And second, because he gave that licentious English monarch, Henry I, a letter, as we've already noticed when we spoke about St. Patrick, a letter in which he called upon him to go and conquer Ireland and extirpate the nurseries of vice and put an end to the wicked habits of the church in Ireland, which did not recognize the authority of the pope, and which cut the hair in the wrong way and observed Easter in the wrong way and a few other minor points. And he called on this wicked English king to put an end to these things in Ireland. And Ireland was conquered by Henry I with this blessing of this one English pope that there has been in all history. But number two, the investiture controversy. This was the thing that stirred the pope during this particular century, more than most anything else, was the question, how does a man become a bishop? And it was a serious question, because by this time, the church owned perhaps a fourth of all the lands of Europe. Maybe a third of the lands of England were in the hands of the church. And the result was that many large areas were controlled by a bishop who was practically like a count or like a duke. He controlled this area, and for protection of the area, he had to furnish troops to the king under the feudal system. And he was actually a political ruler as well as a spiritual leader, and the king wanted authority. And so the king said, I have the right to appoint the bishop. And as proof of this right, I give the bishop the symbols of his office. And the Cluny reformers wished to get away from control by the state. In fact, Gregory had gone so far as he had said that the pope and the emperor are like the sun and the moon. He said the church is like the sun, the state is like the moon. It shines only by reflected light. It must be subject to the church in anything on which the church desires to express a decision. And this is the attitude which many of these popes were trying to take. And they condemned the rulers of all the countries of Europe on various grounds from time to time, many of them real moral lapses or wicked acts which they strongly condemned. In some cases they excommunicated them. In certain cases the kings resisted. In other cases the kings submitted. But it all focused more or less on this question: who is going to have the authority to appoint the bishop? And the authority was represented by the giving to the bishop of the symbol of his authority. And under that, I'm going to call number three Thomas a Becket. Thomas a Becket. Thomas, T-H-O-M-A-S, and then they put a little A, an apostrophe, and then capital B-E-C-K-E-T, Thomas a Becket. And under this heading, Thomas a Becket, I'm going to briefly speak of relations between the kings of England and the Pope during this period. You remember that William the Conqueror, before he conquered England, had secured the approval and support of the Pope. And so when he conquered England, then the Pope said, "If with my sanction you have conquered England, now England really belongs to me, and you must do fealty to me for England, recognize me as your superior, and you hold England by my grace." And William said, "No," he said, "I hold England by my sword, not by your grace." And he said, "I appreciate the help you gave me to conquer England, and I am ready to support your control, and I am ready to give heavy taxes to you from the churches in England, and to do all these things, but the final authority in England is mine and not yours." And this came to a focus when it came to the question of who would be head of the Church of England. And the French rulers, Norman French rulers, William the Conqueror and his successors, replaced the Saxon heads of the Church of England with Norman, with French. And Lanfranc, William the Conqueror, made to be Archbishop of Canterbury. And then when Lanfranc was Archbishop, when William the Conqueror died and was succeeded by his son William II, or William Rufus as they called him, and when Lanfranc died, William II just didn't appoint him a new Archbishop, but took all the income from it for himself. And he took the income and held the place vacant. And then when, this is shortly before 1100, and when William was taken very sick and thought he was going to die, William II, then he was very anxious that he should be forgiven. And so he invited a friend of Lanfranc named Anselm from France to come over and to become Archbishop of Canterbury and ask forgiveness for his having kept the income and so on for this time, kept the place vacant. But then he recovered, and he repented of his rash decision. And so between William Rufus and Anselm, there was quite a controversy. And the Pope interfered with it. There was quite a struggle between the two. And eventually they worked out a sort of a compromise. But the Pope was having these similar relationships with the kings of France and the emperor and the king of England, with all of them, over this question of the appointment of the head of the church. Now, in England, it so happened that the great grandson of William the Conqueror, about the middle of the 12th century, was a man named Henry II, the man of whom we spoke as that licentious ruler, the one whom Adrian forced. Backed up in his conquest of Ireland. And Henry II had a very able assistant, a chancellor in his government, who was named Thomas a Becket. And Thomas a Becket was a very loyal supporter and helper of Henry II, and the Archbishop of Canterbury's position became vacant, and Henry thought, what a fine thing it would be to have a man as Archbishop of Canterbury who was a close friend of mine and who would do what I want. And he said to Becket, "I'm going to appoint you Archbishop of Canterbury." But Becket seems to have been a man who was determined to be loyal to whatever position he had or whatever organization he was in. There's been much discussion about him, and various views have been held, but this seems to be as probable as any, that he was sincerely a man who, as the king's principal assistant and associate, was loyal to, devoted to the king, but who, if he was put in a different position, would be loyal to whatever that position called. And he resisted, they said, being made Archbishop of Canterbury. He said, I don't want to be in the church. I want to continue as your assistant in the leadership of the government and the control of the army and the direction of England. I don't want to go into the church. And he said, if you appoint me there, he said, you may lose a friend. You may lose a friend, because he said, I will loyally carry out the requirements of whatever I am supposed to be doing. Well, Henry said, just forget that. He said, you're a good friend of mine, stand with me. And he said, you can already see that, can't stand with me just as much if you're Archbishop of Canterbury. But Becket seems to have been a different sort of man. At any rate, he became Archbishop of Canterbury. And there, as soon as he became Archbishop of Canterbury, and he was ordained, and went through all the positions of quickly to rise to the stand of the head of the Church of England, he took it all very seriously. And he took off his beautiful garments, and he put on a hair shirt, and he began performing the various ascetic observances that were supposed to be required. And he went to Rome, and he talked with the Pope about what his duties were. And next you know, Henry had a stronger adversary than any he previously had of Archbishop of Canterbury, because as Archbishop of Canterbury, he was 100% loyal to the church and trying to protect the church all the way down the line from anything that he thought was the king interfering beyond what his rights were. And the feeling got so intense between them that the time came when Henry said to some of his nobles one day, he said that, oh, he said, if people really were devoted to me, he said, how would they sit by and see this priest make so much trouble for me and cause me so much misery as he does? Surely, if they really loved me, they would do something about it. And these knights who were devoted to brawling and fighting and that sort of thing anyway, said, well, the king's spoken pretty clearly what he wants. He'd like to be rid of him. Let's get him rid of him. So they went down to Canterbury Church, and they went in, and they spoke very harshly to Becket, and Becket stood up and faced them, and replied just as harshly as they spoke. Most of his men fled in terror, but he seems to have faced them very gravely. So it was a very different spirit from what Byrne did. So, but after all, he was a practical man. He was not a thinker. He was a man who was deeply loyal to whatever he was directly concerned with, and he was ready to stand for it and take the consequences, whatever he might be. And in the end, the knights attacked him and killed him. And this made a terrible sensation through England and all through Europe. And the king was excommunicated, and England was ordered to make restitution and to seek forgiveness before it could receive the blessing or fellowship of the Pope. And wife and sons of the king turned against him, made a rebellion. There were various disasters in the land. And in 1174, King Henry II made a pilgrimage to the tomb of Thomas a Becket. And there he dismounted from his horse when he came in sight of the towers of Canterbury, walked as a penitent pilgrim in a woolen shirt with bare and bleeding feet through the streets, knelt in the porch of the cathedral, kissed the sacred stone on which the archbishop had fallen, threw himself prostrate before the tomb in the crypt, and confessed to the bishop with groans and tears his deep remorse for the hasty words which had led to the murder. And King placed his head and shoulders on the tomb and submitted to being scourged, receiving 5 stripes from each bishop and abbot and 3 stripes from each of the 80 monks. And then he spent the whole night on the bare ground of the crypt in tears and prayers, imploring the forgiveness of the canonized saint in heaven whom he had persecuted on earth. 50 years later, Becket relics were transferred with great solemnity to a great shrine in the reconstructed Canterbury Cathedral. And there began pilgrimages to Canterbury. Those of you who know much about English literature know that one of the first great works of English literature was Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, which consists of the stories told by a group of pilgrims on their way to Canterbury some centuries after this time. But Thomas of Becket was the great saint of England until the time of the Reformation. And there's hardly a case in history where a king has so humiliated himself before the church as Henry II found it necessary to do because of the great revulsion against him on account of the death of Henry. Now here's a case of Thomas. Now here's a case where Thomas submitted and was a martyr, and indeed it advanced what he stood for 1,000 times more than what he possibly could have done if he had fled or if he had continued to fight for his life. But the whole situation was a certain way. That doesn't mean that I don't think that Berengar could have had any similar effect if he had submitted and been killed. But under the situation, and of course everyone, I think, feels a certain respect for those who are willing to suffer for what they believe, rather than to submit and say things like Galileo did when Galileo was told to say that the earth stands still and the sun goes around it, and he had to bow before the Pope and publicly declare this, and he did so. And of course they claim that he said under his tone, "Nevertheless, it does move." Galileo showed the same spirit exactly as Berengar did, and Galileo was not mistreated any more than Berengar was. But he does not stand out as an example of courage. Well, we continue there tomorrow and Thursday.